Yes, we're going to be going through medieval yoga, which is a pretty big term. So I've chosen to look at the Hatha Pradipika. Why have I chosen the Hatha Pradipika? I've chosen it because from the 16th century onwards, Hatha Yoga became the most dominant form of yoga in India. It's known as the classical text for Hatha Yoga. It's the most widespread and well-known text. It's pretty interesting that it's a text known for classical Hatha Yoga because the Pradipika itself combines so many different systems. It's compiled from over than 20 different texts. Some of the systems that do compile this text is contradictionary, which, as Nick already has touched upon, is not necessarily a problem. When you go into the philosophical details of these works, many of them contradict themselves a bit. We take some from Vedanta, we take some from Sankhya, we take some from Tantra, but it's not really a problem, mostly because yoga is a practical solution to the whole problems of existence. Another thing about Hatha Pradipika is that it's the first text that explicitly teaches Hatha above other methods of yoga. It's the first text that combines, that includes non-seated asanas, kumbhakas, complex kumbhakas, breath, pranayama exercises, and satkamani, cleansing techniques, which has become very widespread. Also, I would like to say that yoga scholarship is evolving a lot over the years. There is no final saying. This is like a state-of-the-art presentation. I'm drawing mostly on Alexis Sanderson's knowledge on Tantra and then James Mallinson and his Hatha Yoga Project work in this. Also, I'm not relating it exactly to contemporary use. I suppose that's what Anu did a lot, and I'm very grateful she did that. How can we actually use this stuff? I'm leaving this up to you to figure out for yourself during the way.
How do you spell that text?
Hatha? Hatha Pradipika. The last place we actually stopped in history was the Patanjala Yoga Sastra, another name for the Yoga Sutras. And now I'm jumping straight to Hatha Pradipika, which was composed around 1450. So I would just like to say a few words what happened in between here. Yoga was developed, but we didn't see any explicit yoga text that only concerned about yoga. We saw it in the Vedanta writings, the Advaita Vedantins especially. We see it in the Puranas, and we see it in both the Buddhist and the Hindu Tantras. Yoga was definitely described here. But you could also say for many of the Tantras, yoga was one system, yes, but it was not always the best one. Abhinavagupta, for example, didn't think that yoga was better than gnosis as a way to achieve liberation. So then I could ask, why do we have no texts in this period? Which is highly related to who actually practiced yoga. Who were the yoga practitioners? They were mostly ascetics. And ascetics and scholarship are not common bedfellows. They don't go very well together. Yoga was mainly based on a guru tradition. Again, you get the instructions from your guru, from your own tradition, so you don't need all these texts necessarily. This made yoga very open to and able to adapt to different traditions and different systems, which we see a lot. This goes for the same with philosophy. Yoga was a practical discipline aimed at liberation. So we can see in a quote from Dattatreya Yoga Sastra, 13th century early Hatha Yoga text, where it says, "Whether a Brahmin, an ascetic, a Buddhist, a Jain, a skull-bearer, or a materialist, the wise man who is endowed with faith and constantly devoted to the practice of Hatha Yoga will attain complete success." It doesn't matter what philosophy you come from, actually. Here we have Kapalikas, the skull-bearing ascetics, practicing at the cremation ground. We have the Vedantins, the Jain, the Buddhist. All of them used yoga to achieve liberation. This is also stated in the Hatha Pradipika that yoga is a practical and not necessarily intellectual exercise. The first part of Pradipika, verse 65, it says, "The practitioner will succeed, the non-practitioner will not. Success in yoga is not achieved by merely reading books." I would also like to say that here we have what we see in one tradition, we have two traditions. We have the learned scholars who sat down and wondered about metaphysics, who wrote these works. And then we had the actual practitioners. And they were necessarily not the same. Of course, there's been overlapped, but in one school, we will have these two traditions. probably in the same. So the question is, why do we see these yoga texts coming now from here, early 13th century and onwards?
I noticed when Nick conferred with you and he said Hatha Yoga Pradipika, and you said no,
Hatha Pradipika, simply in the colophones, it's mainly known as the Hatha Pradipika. In the old manuscripts, okay. It's known as the Hatha Pradipika,
okay.
But it's popularly known as the Hatha Yoga Pradipika.
Okay.
Yeah.
Normally it was originally called
Hatha Pradipika, which means light on Hatha, you can say.
Which is why Iyengar called light on yoga, wasn't it?
Yes.
Ahead of you, back to that.
Exactly.
Sorry, what was
that? Iyengar.
Iyengar called light on yoga.
Because
it was referring back
to the Hatha Pradipika. This is also interesting because a lot of the modern yoga we see, we will revisit Patanjali Yoga Sastra in the next, which is about modern yoga, because it's used as a big authority for modern yoga practice. But a lot of the yoga we see today actually have more in common with these medieval traditions. So we're going to look at those now. Why did those texts come now? Is a good question. This is a key to understanding the Hatha Yoga literature in general. These practices that were practiced by ascetics for, as Nick has said, we don't know how long. We don't know about the origins of yoga. They were adapted to a householder audience. They started to become manuals. So many of the practices were becoming more tamed down, because it's a very, very time-consuming practice to be an ascetic. So this was to make it able for householders to practice. We don't know to what extent householders and women, for that sake, actually practiced yoga, but it becomes more and more possible with these manuals. Another reason is that yoga is starting to be taken away from its sectarian roots. The environments that actually composed that practiced yoga. And we're going to look a bit on these sectarian roots. The Shaiva Age, as identified by Alexis Sanderson. Even though yoga cannot be understood as an isolated tradition only within Shaivism or Vaishnavism, Shaktism, Buddhism, but it's all been a melting soup of everything. This is a very good point to look at. The Shaiva Age arose in the non-Puranic Shaivism. That means the one that didn't come out from the Puranas, but the more non-mainstream practices. One of the first developments, this is earlier than than 600, but we don't know when this started, is the Atimagga, which is known as the outer path. This was, and Malyuta practitioners were ascetics, non-Vedic ascetics, but definitely celibate ascetics. Their male Brahmins mostly practiced it, and their main aim was moksha. And they also focused a lot on the positive outcomes of brahmacharya, this celibacy that we also looked upon in the Patanjali Yoga Sastra. It's sometimes called Raudra rather than Shaiva, because some of it is so old that before Shiva actually emerged as a big god, they worshipped the predecessor of Shiva, known as Rudra, who was also known to live on the edge of established society and, a marginal god from the Vedic pantheon.
It's interesting, though. Shiva himself is not celibate.
But that's the beautiful thing about Shiva is that we call him the god of paradox. Because Shiva is on one side the perfect ascetic sitting alone in the Himalayas, but he's also the perfect family father with Parvati and Ganesh and Kumar and all this. Shiva has both poles on him, and it's actually these two poles that I'm going to try to identify, these practitioners. We see that also in Tantra. We see left-hand Tantra and we see right-hand Tantra. These two very extreme poles that are in Hinduism. This is why you can say, Hinduism is about being vegetarian, but it's also about sacrificing animals to the goddess. Both of them are present in Hinduism. Yeah?
We have all these Atimagga. Are these the Nagas as well? Because it says the skull-bearing.
Skull-bearing? Well, that's very interesting. They might be
associated with cremation, at least.
Exactly. They are probably early. They have developed all the way through. But we cannot really say whether it's a direct line to the Nagas, the Dasanami Samyasins, or the Nav Sampradaya, all this. We're going to look more at the different ascetic groups later. They only started to formate into different orders in the 16th, 17th century. So at this time, it's more open.
So these practices that you describe here are more associated with tantric practices. So does that predate some of the more rituals as we know today?
Yes. And they are more associated with Tantra. We're moving to Tantra right now. Out of the Ajimagga, another path developed called the Mantramagga. The Mantramagga provided a new ritual approach, a very complex ritual approach, which we know from Tantra. And it became available for both ascetics and householders, women and low-caste people. Also, the aim is substituted, or another one is added. Moksha is not longer the most important practice. Siddhi and Bhoga. Siddhi are these magical powers that can arise from yoga practice, and Bhoga is simply enjoyment, pleasure, one can say. Generally in yoga we know this. We already looked at the third chapter of the Yoga Sutra. In some yoga traditions, in most yoga traditions, siddhis, these magical powers have to be renounced because they are a distraction from the real goal. But in some tantric traditions, this becomes the final goal, which is more important than moksha. It can be to be, flight, hear and see very, very, everywhere, no past, present, future, a master of alchemy. Often a siddhi is just mentioned as the ability to do whatever one wants. And this became an aim for these ascetics and householders in this period. Yeah. So before we move anywhere, we're moving into Tantra now. These were Tantra. So I would like to just make some preliminaries about Tantra. I would like to read off my minimal definition of Tantra, which is from Alexis Sanderson. You also have it on your handout. The scriptural revelations of the Shaiva mainstreams are called tantras, and those that act in accordance with their prescriptions are consequently termed tantrics, tantrikas. The term tantra means simply a system of ritual or essential instruction, but when it is applied in the special context, it serves to differentiate itself from the traditions that derive their authorities from the Vedas, the direct revelation, the Shrutis, and a body of later texts has claimed to be Veda-based, the Smriti. So what we simply have is a stream in Indian philosophy that does not accept the Vedas authorities. Many people then end up saying that Tantra is anti-Vedic, which is not entirely true, because what really, really is important in the Vedic literature is ritual. And Tantra is highly ritualized. It's such a complex ritual structure. So in some way it's actually super Vedic, because it's hyper-ritualistic in that way. It cannot be dated earlier than 500-600. Most of the tantric texts are from the 8th century. We also have Buddhist materials in the tantras. Many Buddhist tantras were wrote. It looks like most of them came from the Shaiva material, but that's a big discussion among scholars, and I don't want to get into that or say who's more right than the other.
It's a question that arose even with all the previous lectures. Very often we are dating something based on when the text was available. But given that some of the Indian philosophical tradition or thing was an oral tradition, yes, before it was written into the text, so they could have easily existed even well before that.
They could have so easily existed well before that, and especially by these yogic practices. I think that asana, or at least forerunner of asana, has been practiced for a very long time. And the whole thing about dating Indian text is that it's like a house of cards. If one of the datings are wrong, the whole system collapses.
Yeah.
In that sense.
That's a very nice analogy.
Oliver used exactly those words, didn't he? He said, you know, you can't date anything more than 200 years because it is a house of cards.
Exactly. And you just pull one away and everything collapses. Yeah. Yeah.
Because this is the reason why a lot of the texts are also pithy, so that they could be by-hearted and transmitted.
Yeah, transmitted through tradition, through guru tradition, yeah. You're saying something?
That's particularly true with Tantra because it's an oral tradition.
And it's secret.
Books of Vidya was meant to not be written. It started to be written much later.
Exactly.
And the Vedic part is also, there is an understanding in this tradition that we look to the Vedas not as something that not against Vedas, but Vedas is no longer understood as something that is valid for the nowadays life. So it's like there will be a time that that knowledge will be used again.
Again.
But it's not the time now. So that's how the tantrics understand. So now it's time for tantras. So basically,
exactly.
Not a total negation, but it's an understanding that there is a cycle.
Well, yeah, and that everything develops and that the traditions has to develop along this and what's the need of who's ever in the time. And that's what yoga has done. Yoga has adapted to so many traditions over the year.
Well, you said that the people sometimes said that Tantra was anti-Vedic.
Yeah.
But you didn't believe that because they were even more powerful. Would it be, I mean, just thinking that the Mimamsa tradition, you do this yajna in a particular part of way, then you get this fruit, or you can control Indra, you can control Vayu, you can control all of that. So all of that comes in. Probably Tantra believe that their method of ritual is even more powerful
than the Vedic one.
Than the Vedic one. So it goes even beyond that control. That.
That's what they would say. And the most tantric systems would also still use the Vedic ritual system, but for lower aspirants, people who are not ready for the tantric one, in a sense. So it's not totally negating, and there is nothing like this is so not connected. Everything is connected in these, and they all build on each other. The same with Hinduism and Buddhism. They've been playing ball together and developed their ideas together. Wouldn't have been one without the other. It's a more, yeah.
So could you just tell me that you said there was a god worship predating Shiva?
Rudra.
Rudra.
Yeah.
And at that time, Shiva was not recognized?
Shiva was only like introduced. He's not in the Vedic literature. Like we see the rise of Shiva and the three streams of Hinduism, Vaishnavism, Shaktism, Shaivism, around the 2nd century. They're like being established as these three. Shiva is not mentioned in any Vedic literature.
They mention Rudra.
They mention Rudra, who we think is a pre-Shiva.
Yeah.
But again, texts are not time machines. And we also always have to remember that. Also, all these texts, the same as the Hatha Pradipika, it's a model for reality, not a model of reality. We don't know if this was actually what was practiced in 1450 when Svatmarama wrote the Hatha Pradipika. We have to be cautious about that. They're not text machines, and scholars often forget that.
Somebody said when you read something written by someone, that's his perspective.
Exactly.
But not necessarily what exactly was
what going on. Yeah. Yeah. So back to the tantras. So now we know it's basically what I would say a bunch of scriptures. These scriptures, they often have four subjects they cover. One is doctrine, vidya or jnanapara. Second is ritual, the kriyapada, very important in tantras. Many tantras are basically ritual manuals, very complex ritual manuals. Then they have a yoga pada, simply a yoga chapter. And a chapter about discipline or correct behavior, which we could call the chayapada. There are, however, some common features in tantra. We have a very high focus on rituals. We have a practice that's very related to meditation, which is visualization on and or identification with the deity. Practically, one becomes Shiva, if we say this is a Shaiva tantric tradition, by ascending through all the tattvas, the element of existence, until one gets dissolved, laya, into the supreme tattva, which often is the main deity. Many tantric traditions say that to worship Shiva, you have to become Shiva yourself. Tantras are like we have before. We have them in both dual. Some of them are dualistic. Some of them are non-dual. That's very, very different. We have a high importance of guru and initiation, often secret tradition. And then many tantras have something we see a lot developed in later yoga traditions. Identification between the microcosmos and the macrocosmos. We see this in the yogic body, We have rivers inside the body, nadis, that are taken to be like, yeah, from the nature. So we are all a small microcosmic manifestation of the big one. There are so many divisions and different traditions within how the tantrics developed, and I don't want to go into many of them, but I want to say that one major difference in tantra is between what we can call the wild, hardcore, left-hand Vamachara tantra, which could look something like this. Here we have a cremation ground-centered worship of the goddess Kali. It's very easy in this picture to see that Kali is the center and that Shiva is actually worshipping Kali. We're going into Shaktism in a while as well, which is quite interesting in this development. It could also be mild, softcore, right-hand tantra. The right and left-hand logic is very easy when you know the Indian use of the right and left hand, right? Use the right hand for eating and you use the left hand when you go visit the toilet. So one is highly concerned about purity and one does the exact opposite. Dakshina Chara. And that could look something like this. This is from Kamakshi. Yeah, the South Indian, exactly.
She's Kamakshi. Was told here, Kanchi Kamakshi.
Yeah, Tripura.
And there is the mandala at the bottom.
There, the mandala, exactly. That's the Sri Vidya. This is like the mild traditions of Tantra. So people often think that Tantra is only about, impurity and these kind of practices, but it can be all of it. Yeah. The left-hand Tantra is often worshipping forms of the goddess. She often demands blood, alcohol, and sexual fluids. We're going to talk a bit about tantric sex because it's... Yesterday I checked the hashtag Tantra on Instagram. And it was basically people having sexual encounters trying to achieve multiple orgasms. So it's something very popular, but it's not exactly what actually happened. We're going to look into that in a...
It's like Sai Sutra, yeah. Kama Sutra.
Yeah, they also relate Tantra and Kama Sutra, yeah. The goddess in these wild tantric cults, she demanded blood sacrifices, both human and animal. And also these sexual rituals were mostly concerned about producing sexual substances like semen or blood or whatever we can produce, mix them together, offer them and drink them. So the main purpose of tantric ritual... In these very early days, is simply to produce these substances, the sublimation of the tantric ritual into a reenactment of the Shiva and Shakti is a much later interpretation we see later. It's highly connected to ritualized use of substances which are prohibited within Vedic Orthodox Hinduism. These practices use impurity to transcend through reality. There is no right or wrong. That's something we impose on the world. Tantra is a lot about dissolving all these categories that we see in the world. I have here used the goddess as an example, and I have done that very much on purposely because I think Shaktism is very important. Like the yogic body, the conception of chakra and kundalini seems to come from goddess-centered tantric traditions, and this is a pretty new one. Out of this Atimaga and Mantramaga, you would normally say that goddess traditions were merely a subsect of Shaivism. However, Sanderson's new research showed that there were an independent and probably ancient tradition going all the way back to the Atimaga, what he calls the Atimaga III, the Kapalikas, the skull-bearing ascetics living on the cremation ground that worshipped the wild form of Chandika, an early form of Kali, we could say.
Chandima.
Yeah. Here is an important development. Straight from the Atimaga, it's called Kulamaka. Kula means family, simply. You have Kula Devs in modern Hinduism. In these early traditions, it refers to a family of goddesses or yoginis. The first mention we get of yoginis are not necessarily yogic practitioners, actually. Yoginis were more associated with demons, that you had to like offer these substances to either learn to control them or become friendly with them or at least just keep them at bay. That's the same with Rudra. People often worship Rudra to actually keep him, to stay away, because he's a pretty fierce, powerful deity. Yeah. Kulamaga was distinct, was known by a distinct ritual system called Kula Prakriya. This is where we have the sexual rites, for example. And other than that, it has some characterizers. We were talking about possession earlier. This is highly characteristic of goddess-centered traditions. And in India, you do often see it during Navratri or Durga Puja. You see it in Nepal, the Navadurga, where they simply become incarnations of the goddess or become possessed by the goddess. Another one is the consumption of these impure substances. They can be called Panchamrita, they can be called Panchamakara. Sometimes there are five, sometimes there are seven. That's very different. You have the ritual sex, the Duti Yaga, which is very important in goddess tantric traditions. You have blood sacrifices. And lastly, you have a collective orgiastic mode of worship. So this is a very, like, yeah, collective that involved low-caste women. These tantric practitioners had ritual sex with low-caste women to produce these ritual substances to offer the goddesses, simply. In this environment, we encounter four different transmissions, the western, the northern, the southern, and the eastern. The pictures we saw before of the Maya goddess is from the southern transmission. But what we will work on today is the western transmission. It has the root text Kupchika Mata Tantra from the 10th century, and it's centered around Kupchika, which means like the hunchbacked goddess. Not a pretty goddess, a wild, wild goddess. Normally we have a very rough saying that the wild goddesses came to the north and the mild goddesses went south. It's a very rough saying, but yeah, to say something.
Can I just ask a quick question? So you mentioned that these practices involve low-caste women. Is there any sense of whether there was any agency in terms of what, you know, if the women had any agency, if there any choice in that?
That's very, very interesting question, the role of that, because it seems like early that the women were more ritual instruments, but it is a general tendency in Tantra that the woman is viewed as more powerful and has more power and more agency than in many of the orthodox early Brahminical developments. But it's something we don't know much about. Most of the yoga texts are written by male Brahmins for male Brahmins. So this all lies within the fact we know nothing about what happened outside the texts. Again, they're not a time machine.
Yeah,
yeah, so we're not entirely sure
how
the women are.
I'm asking because I did a lot of reading recently on the yogini cults, and a lot of the writings have to be read with that in mind. You know, who wrote them and why?
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly. Exactly. So we don't know much about that.
What other caste of women would have been available? They wouldn't. Mm. This is it.
Yeah.
Poor people.
Yeah. And that implies that it wasn't by choice.
It implies. I'm the only single.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know, but it seems like when we have the high sublimation of these, like with Abhinavagupta and stuff, that these were developed and also entered the Brahminical society and were also practiced by females who were regarded equal with their male practitioners in later tantric traditions. But it's not a clear picture at all. We only have the texts. Cannot go back there and check it out. But around the 9th century, these wild goddess cults, they got transformed. They met Brahminical circles and then they turned more into some erotic, mystical worship that we call Kaulism, which would contra the Kula. So they internalized these practices. For example, you didn't have to actually offer these substances, but you can do it internally, like in meditation. You can visualize that you're doing all these transgressive practices, but you don't actually have to do it. You can give the goddess a bali, but still be a vegetarian if you want to. You can go do it from the inside. We see this highly in Tibetan Buddhism today, which is a tantric tradition. They often internalize all the practices and don't do any of it external.
Manasa puja.
Yeah. And the chit praxis and stuff like that. Yeah. These practices now started to focus more on a subtle visualizing meditation. I would call this high cultural Shaktism, actually, what many of them does. And why this is interesting is because much modern yoga scholarship states that Hatha yoga comes from these traditions with tantric sexualized rituals. Hatha yoga Pradipika is ascribed to the forerunners of the Navasampradaya, an ascetic development in India, whose first historical gurus, Guraksha and Machyendranath, were members of this Western transmission cult, one of the yogini cults, centered around the goddess Kupchika. But it seems like Hatha was rather appropriated by tantric traditions later, around the time the Hatha Pradipika were composed. It is a reworking of tantric terminology. We will find a lot of the words we know, like mudra, was used a lot in tantric literature, mostly meaning hand gestures or installments of the deity in the body, which came to become physical techniques in the practice of Hatha yoga. The Hatha yoga in this, the tantric elements also became less esoteric in this period. Was again, the Hatha yoga corpus was mainly composed to take all these practices and make them available for the householder. So that is the context we're working in, and that's the same with Tantra. It's also why it's going to be a while until we come to the Hatha Pradipika, because even though it's a very easy text to read, if we compare it to the Yoga Sutra, it takes a lot of background to actually understand what's going on, because some of the verses simply contradict each other. It describes sexual rites, but it also says that you have to be celibate. Which leads me to the main point that is like the most important in what I'm going to try to do in this session. Shaivism, in its great internal diversity, is the result of the interplay of two fundamental orientations, a liberation-seeking asceticism embodied in Atimagga and a power-seeking asceticism of Kapalika character within the Mantramagga. These are two very different yogic paradigms. We're back to looking at the practitioners who are actually these yogis. We can broadly understand this division between one group of ascetics who are known as rishis or munis. Rishis are also the ones who are known to have heard the Rig Veda, and the munis mean the silent ones. And other groups as ascetics known as siddhas or yogis, which Guraksha and Machyendra would be examples of. The interplay between these two ascetic traditions is fundamental to understanding how yoga developed in these ages. Machyendra, one of the known first gurus of Hatha yoga, is said to actually have reformed these wild tantric practices to the more internalized form we see in Kaulism. But as we see in the 13th century Machyendra Samhita, a text about his cult still involved sexual and other unorthodox practices. The Nav Sampradaya and their textual, they've been claiming Hatha yoga to be theirs, and scholarship has actually basically just accepted this until not long ago. Yeah?
I'm from Nava Sampradaya, actually.
And, yeah?
That's this idea that Madison is putting forward is obviously not accepted in tradition.
Yes, of course it's not.
There are the other ideas as well, but he's basically advocating to his tradition, which is quite funny, isn't it?
Yeah, which is quite funny, because that's the Ramanandis and the...
It's totally, it's non-Shiva.
Sorry, what does Kapa mean?
Kapalika, that's the skull-bearing ascetics.
The skull-bearing ascetics.
Yeah.
Okay, Kapalika.
Mm. Kapalika.
Because there's another name for Shiva, Kapalishwara.
Yeah.
Kapalishwara.
Yeah. Yeah, the lord of the skull-bearers. Yeah. Well, I am basing much of my work on Malingson. I do work with the modern Nav Sampradaya in Nepal. That's my basic research, actually, working with Nav women in that tradition. But it does seem like that the Nav sources maintain that Machyendra's disciple Guraksha further reformed all these wild practices and rescued Machyendra from his ensnarement in the land of women. So we have this yogic tradition claiming that they here became celibate and they fully internalized the sexual practices. from this story, I can say there is no historical way that Machyendra was Gorakshas' guru. There are a couple of centuries between them. If we look at textual sources, which again is the only thing we have. And Goraksha himself is also said to have two wives in some travelers' descriptions. So if he was celibate or not, we actually don't know. We know what the tradition itself says, and we can see the text, and they sometimes propose different pictures, but there's no final saying in it. We will now see how Hatha Yoga came to be claimed, however. I can start by saying the earliest reference to Hatha Yoga by name is in an 8th century Buddhist text. It doesn't say anything about the practices of Hatha Yoga or describes it any further. We have to go a bit far up in that. Out of the 20 plus more texts that is used for the compilation of the Hatha Pradipika, only 4 texts call it Yoga Hatha, and only 1 describes its practices. That's the Dattatreya Yoga Sastra. In this text from the 13th century, around, well, all dates, we have to add around after, we see a yoga typology that is like developed here. And here I would exactly like to insist, because now, as you could also hear us talking about, this is actually a battle between the Shaivas and the Vaishnavas, who found out Hatha Yoga, because now we've been through all this Shaiva Shakta, but the Dattatreya Yoga Sastra is from a super extra Vedic ascetic Vaishnava school, suddenly coming in and having something to say on Hatha Yoga. And I think that the Vaishnava origins and the Shaiva origins of some of this is something we need to develop more and investigate more, because it's very interesting the interplay between them, and do they always have this polemic against each other? Many of them do live similar lifestyles today and have the same kind of North Indian ascetic appearance. So it's very difficult to tell legend from history, so to say. What we do see is a yoga typology where we have mantra yoga. Mantra yoga is basically the repetition of mantras. It's known in the mantra marga to be the best way to be known as the best way to attain siddhis, these supernatural powers. Another form of yoga is laya yoga. The purpose of this is to reach citta laya, which is the dissolution of the mind. Happens by when you dissolve the self and the material world, but then you are followed by a fusion of the two, in a sense. How do laya yoga practically happen? They have a kind of like secret techniques, you can call them. They're known as samketas. They comprise a variety of meditation and visualizations of places and energies in the body. Chakras, kundalini, is actually from laya yoga, and it's actually in contrast with many of the physical practices of early hatha yoga. To raise kundalini, to pierce the chakras, to listen to an inner sound that stimulates the yogic meditations, known as nada yoga. These are also some of the developments we don't know much about in modern scholarship. These meditational aspects of yoga has not been looked that much upon yet. And we haven't identified where the verses from Nada Yoga actually comes from in the Pradipika.
Actually, there isn't in English, but there are some good works in French.
In French, yeah, the Netra Tantra. And
I'm very close with the research there, and it's quite interesting because these practices are not so mysterious. Some of them were written in 1982. 1983 was the one book that I was reviewing on it. So they are quite hidden in the text, but they are there. So for those who know, the information is there. It's deliberately placed in a way that you're not going to understand if you don't see it, but it's there. So it's, but I see that in English there isn't much people looking beyond Alex Sanderson towards this tradition.
No.
In French is quite a lot.
Yeah.
And one of them is still alive, with Stara Michael. And if you were interested in work on the Tantra, she did an amazing work in this side. And the Hatha Yoga Pradipika in French is still the one that she written in 1974. So like she had probably the first to write about the Natas.
Yeah, the Natas, yeah.
So it's still there, but I don't know why. Most English
Yeah, most English literature doesn't work much about it yet.
They don't go beyond.
Yeah, yeah. So there is still a lot to be figured out about these traditions and the meditational aspects of Hatha Yoga. We have one more type of yoga, or maybe two, depending on how we see it. Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga is in the Dattatreya Yoga Sastra, taught after an eight-limbed yoga that's very similar to Patanjali. Here it's not ascribed to Patanjali, though, but to Yajnakalbya. It doesn't necessarily have to be like Ashtanga Yoga kind of lived its own life after the Yoga Sutras. Many systems used eight-limbed, five-limbed, 15, whatever, and they were not only ascribed to Patanjali. But what I would just like to state is that Hatha Yoga is not opposed to Patanjali Yoga necessarily. It's often the system are overlaid onto each other. It's just a normal conception that you have to either read the Patanjali Yoga Sutra or the Hatha Pradipika because they're so different and contradictory. But the yoga text themselves doesn't seem to have this strong contradiction between them. So what's unique about the practice of Hatha Yoga? What sets it apart from the other parts of yoga is actually the mudras. The mudras at this point are physical techniques to manipulate the breath or other vital energies running around the body. The Dattatreya teaches 10 mudras. The Mahamudra, for example, it also teaches the three bandhas, the three locks, still used very much in modern yoga today. It teaches Kichari Mudra, a mudra we will look more specific on. But all has the aim of keeping Bindu in the head. Now, Bindu in this context, Bindu means drop or point, but in this context it means semen, simply. So it's a lot related to the yogic body and how the yogic body works. And we're going to look at that just in a minute, because that's where the whole understanding these different systems all piled together as Hatha Yoga seems to come from.
I'm glad Carl Jung never practiced yoga. He would have a field day with the theory.
Yeah. It's also always very interesting to talk about this because people often come to a lecture on Tantra or yoga and wanting to hear about like how to achieve multiple orgasms or what is all these physical postures about. And then we often sit and talk about cremation grounds and sublimation of semen and stuff like that. But that's also a part of yoga history.
Yeah, I watched a really bad documentary years and years ago. I don't know if it was about Tantra or Tantra sex. I don't remember. But it talks about this. About how they keep
the name
and...
Yeah. That is a big part of it. Would also like to address one thing before we move on to the final type of yoga. What does Hatha Yoga actually mean?
Force.
Force. Is it then the state of yoga achieved by the means of force, or does it talk about that the practices are forceful in themselves? That's the whole thing. Like, scholars today disagree, and I don't want to choose a side.
Practice creates force.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, in the Hatha Pradipika, shanai, shanai is used so often, and that means gently, gently, softly, softly. So it's not necessarily connected to forceful in that sense. I think Mallinson would say that it's not a kind of yoga that's called Hatha, but methods that are forceful, that lead to a goal called yoga. This is because it's closely related to the practice of tapas, austerities. They were difficult and they often forced their results to happen. We're going to look more closely at it when I will look into the asana development, because this is also what actually says that Hatha Yoga does not come from tantric tradition, but from much more older ascetic traditions, that these ascetics has been assuming positions known as asanas, but they have been choosing one and they have been standing there for 10 hours a day. You see at the mela today, you see ascetics who raise their arm. This is tapas, and this is properly where asana has its origin, and not in the tantric traditions. But we're going to look at that when we reach the asana chapter a bit later. There is also another definition of Hatha Yoga, which is quietly popular today. I think Chandravasu wrote it in an introduction to Giranda Samhita in 1875 or something, so it's been known to the West quite early, which is an esoteric definition that ha is the sun and Tha is the moon, and the union of the two is Hatha Yoga.
Do those words actually mean sun and moon? No.
No. Syllables.
So it's just made up.
It's,
I've heard it so many times.
Yeah, well, it's made up, but so is the other definition of Hatha Yoga. I'm just saying that this is from Yoga Bija, which is like...
But the word Hatha actually means force.
Force,
in Sanskrit.
Yeah.
So it's less made up than sun and moon.
Yeah, probably. That's probably a tantric appropriation of Hatha Yoga. They like these esoteric definitions, in a sense. Tantra has tried, like Hatha Pradipika is not the first text that tries to take the practices of Hatha Yoga and claim them to the broad Siddha tradition, where Guraksha and Machyendra, we see it in Shiva Samhita and some of the other early works, that they are trying to like fuse. Actually, what they're trying to do is to fuse Laya Yoga and Hatha Yoga into one system. So when I talk about Hatha Yoga, I talk about early Hatha Yoga and classical Hatha Yoga. Classical Hatha Yoga, as we see in the Pradipika, is a mixture of Laya Yoga and Hatha Yoga, all labeled under the name Hatha Yoga. That's where we're moving ahead, because that's the mixing of these two fundamental different ascetic paradigms. We see siddhi, moksha, we see celibacy, we see sexual rites, all of them fusing together in the yoga that came to be the most widespread across all India.
Who was the author who made up Sun Moon?
From Yoga Bija. I don't know who it's attributed to.
Can I ask you something? I don't know if it's... So, if the goal of Hatha Yoga is to keep the semen in the head,
yeah,
how are we as women going to do it?
There is actually a verse in the Hatha Pradipika that says that if a woman who has proper practice can draw the semen from a man and also her own seminal fluids, then she also is a yogini. It's all related. It's all related to the conception of the yogic body, which is the next slide. So I think it will be more clear after that.
Okay. So it'll be very male. I mean,
we are in a very male-dominated world.
It's a male club.
Yeah, it's a male club.
So what did you say? What did you say? That text was called Yoga Bija.
Yoga Bija.
Bija.
Yeah. Probably a bit older than Hatha Yoga Pradipika, but somewhere between. Yeah, 13th and 14th century, most likely. So if we were to see these types of yoga in relation to the two types of ascetics I've been trying to identify, Laya Yoga was probably practiced by siddhas and yogis such as Guraksha and Machyendra. It bears a much greater resemblance to the tantric yoga systems. It focuses on Kundalini, for example, and Hatha most likely were practiced by rishis and munis. Probably originated in the Atimaga, but we do have all this Vaishnava connection as well. Dattatreya, as we see here on the picture, was known as a great muni, a great silent sage.
He's got clothes on. He's not supposed to have any clothes.
He's actually not supposed. This is a child-friendly image. Yeah. The last one, Raja Yoga. Well, many people today know that Raja Yoga is Patanjali Yoga. The first time these two were connected was in a commentary on this in the 16th century. Raja Yoga does not necessarily mean Patanjali Yoga. That's Swami Vivekananda and the Theosophical Society. We're going to look in that in next lesson, next session, who identified these two. However, at this time around, Raja Yoga was often identified simply with Samadhi, the practice of samadhi. So it's some kind of meditational yoga that focuses more on these subtle aspects. In Hatha Pradipika, Raja Yoga and samadhi are viewed as synonyms, simply. Also, the hierarchy between these are very different in different texts, but most would say that Raja Yoga is the highest form of practice. Yeah. We're going to move on to see what's actually going on within these yogas then. The yogic body, and now I've wrote the dried up body. We have two yogic groups with very different paradigms. Important difference, which actually shows a lot of it, lies in the conception of the yogic body. First of all, I would like to say that in modern yoga, the yoga body is empirical, anatomical, biological, biometrical. This is not necessarily how it was in pre-modern yoga traditions. The yogic body were probably more a heuristic model of the human. It was a metaphorical body that not necessarily had any empirical existence, which didn't make it any less real to the yogis, however. In general, I can say that the yogic body is pursued as a network of channels, psychophysical centers like chakras are linked together by these rivers, channels. We know them as nadis, as we see here on the picture. This is the main channel is often known as Sushumna, and the left and the right that go over are known as Ida and Pingala. We also see this in the Hatha Pradipika. In this body of channels and psychophysical centers, energies like kundalini or prana, vital air, could move around. And this channel system is very fundamental in a yogic system. And I would just like to say it is a very old concept. It's not only originating in these. This we actually have textual evidence for in, for example, the Brihadrangaya Upanishad, which mentions 70,002 channels that all originate in the heart. So what we have all together across different traditions is that there is something ascending through the central channel in this yogic body. What that is very different. In this system, which I would connect to the early Hatha traditions, Bindu is the one traveling through the body. Yeah, let's see what Bindu actually is then. I would like to say that to understand the concept of Bindu and the meaning of it, we have to understand the concept of rasa in this tradition. I will not go into a theological discussion about what rasa is, because it's so many things. But I do actually like David Gordon White's view of it. Rasa was and remained a fluid essence of Indian thought. If the universe is a great pulsating flow of essence and manifestation, rasa is the fluid stuff of that flow. So rasa is this vital nectar, in a sense, that runs through everything in the universe. And again, we are in this yogic body that has like micro and microcosm, macrocosm analogies. And in the human body, this is manifested as Bindu.
The Jedi Force.
Yeah. Bindu is again equated with Amrita, the nectar of immortality, or simply nectar. So if we see in normal men, people who don't practice yoga, the Bindu, the semen, simply drops from its lunar store. It has a store in the head of Bindu and keeps dropping down the body. And it's either ejaculated or burned away in the digestive fire. You have to accept the logic that semen equals life, loss of semen equals death. So when all this keeps dripping down, this results in aging and of the body and essentially in death. And the Hatha Pradipika in verse 388, it said, the knower of yoga should preserve his semen and thereby conquer death. Emission of semen is death, preservation of semen is life.
When you use the word semen,
yeah,
are you using it as a metaphorical because it's a giver of life? Because that word, if you take it in a biological sense, makes nonsense.
Yeah.
I am actually in this tradition.
It has to be metaphorical.
In this yogic body that I'm discussing right now, I would actually say that Bindu is an empirical substance.
Why should it make no sense?
Is it different to the semen that we are talking about? Would you say it's a different
the
substance?
Biological semen?
It's the biological semen.
But, no, but there is a biological force, but why would you call it semen? I'm wondering is
this is the substance semen they are talking about.
Contain semen. So.
No. This was not intended
then
for women.
Aren't alive.
So the thing is that if the semen's ejected, then it's death to the semen.
Right.
But actually, when semen's ejected, it's what gives life, proliferation. That's how life continues.
Yeah.
No, but I think.
So it's magical thinking.
Yeah.
It's kind of magical.
But I think, I suppose, is when you're too proactive with the semen thing. You expend your energy.
Yeah.
So the brahmachari lives longer than the grihastha.
That's what they would say in this.
Mm-hmm.
system, yes. And I would say in women it has an equivalent called rajas, people will say. And we can discuss from now until forever if that's the seminal fluid or menstrual blood. Sometimes it's both. Yeah?
There is a differentiation between how the Hatha tradition say that and how the tantric
tradition
say that. In the tantric is quite different. It's not just the semen, but it's the energy that you're generating in the sex. And the man should be able to bring the energy back to
the body.
In terms of biology, the semen is actually different from the seminal fluid. Because the seminal fluid is produced by the prostate.
Yes.
While the semen is produced by the
testicles.
Then the two. So if it is seminal fluid, it makes a certain amount of sense of controlling the ejaculation of the seminal fluid. You can't control that.
Yeah, you can control that.
So they're two actually different things.
In the tantric, you mix both, so the woman will be generating liquid, and
exactly.
They both will absorb each other. So the man should be able to absorb to the urethra, and there is a technique for that.
And the
woman also.
Vajroli mudra, we're going to work on that, because we see that in both traditions. In the celibate tradition, it's like a technique to make sure that your bindu is not lost. Like sometimes men wake up in the morning and have accidentally lost their semen, and then they can like save it back. And in the tantric tradition, Vajroli mudra is a different thing. Mm-hmm. So we have two of them. We have them also with Kichari mudra. We're going to look at that in just a second to try and make this clearer. Because this is you're supposed to be confused about these yogic bodies. And again, we have to... It's not necessarily an empirical body that we can see. It's often something that's created in meditation, especially in the tantric traditions. Yeah. So, but how... The question is, how do we actually do this? Reverse the flow of the bindu. We have to take the bindu and make it ascend up through the main channel of the body, so it's returned to the store of the head. In the store of the head, it's sublimated to amrita, the nectar of immortality, and is prevented from dripping down in the body. This early model represents an ascetic orientation in which the body should be mortified, it should be dried up through tapas and austerities. The body in these traditions, not the tantric traditions, this is totally different, the body is viewed as an obstacle, or at least irrelevant if it's not an obstacle. The broader aim is moksha. We cannot forget that the most important aim for these people were moksha. Often surprising to modern practitioners, I often hear people saying that all this body mortifyingness came from Christianity within and then were mixed and stuff. But actually there are Indian traditions who also had this. So hence, when you can do this, when you can change the natural flow of fluids, you can manipulate the way the natural body works. Hence become a mastering of the universe, a master of the body. Which goes very well with all these ascetics' ideas, in a sense.
So, does that mean that the yogic body doesn't really have a sex? It's not male or female, it's just a body?
Probably, just a body.
Because women can do that as well, you know, bindu is...
Not for Nata tradition, it's just men. There are some Natas in Nepal, from tantric tradition, but that was like considered really something because they were more connected to tantric. But the Natas never sex women, and today very few initiate women. In India, in Nepal is another story.
In Nepal it's another story.
But it was meant for men, not for women. They would be really, really surprised to see the West today.
Yeah.
Just women, no men.
And it is also, the techniques are... To take up the bindu again are definitely... I've only discussed it with gynecologists about men. I don't know if women would actually be able physically to do Vajroli Mudra. I actually don't know that, but we'll see that now. Because the next question is, how is bindu sucked up the central channel to be transformed? It's done through mudras, physical techniques. They could be pneumatically, like working on the breath, by visualizing the breath entering the Susumna Nadi and move everything upwards. That's the one. The other one is mechanically. We see it, for example, in, well, if I say that we like to keep Bindu in the head and then I say headstand, that's one of the origins of why people had the headstand, why these ascetics practices, to keep Bindu mechanically in the head, simply. Another one is Kicharimudra. This is a technique that we're going to look at two times because it's very different in this tradition and the tantric tradition, which is then melted, merged together with this tradition in classical Hatha yoga. I'd like to read a little bit from the Hatha Pradipika. Turn the tongue backward and insert it into the skull cavity. Direct the gaze to the middle of the brows. This is Kicharimudra. Gradually elongate the tongue by cutting, shaking and stretching it until it touches the middle of the brows. Then Kichari is accomplished. The yogi who holds the tongue upward for even half a second is saved from poison, disease, death, old age and so on. The semen does not flow, even when embraced by a passionate woman, if the cavity above the soft palate is sealed with the Kichari. So what does these verses actually say? They say that we take our tongue, we turn them backwards, very bad picture, but we simply seal the cavity within here. You take the tongue, if you're not able to do it naturally, you would cut the thread here on the tongue and then slowly, slowly being able to seal here so the Bindu cannot fall down again.
Does it also not prevent breathing?
Yeah, it's okay to breathe there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But the experience is very intense. This
is known as a very...
Are you breathing through your nose at that point?
You can breathe through your nose, but you can block the nostrils, so you can do an Abhishodhana Pranayama, the alternate nostrils from inside. So you can do that. But then
different levels,
so the first level is just basically turn the tongue back.
Back, yeah.
And then move up with time. But the tongue fits it exactly inside the cavity.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's a little bit weird in the beginning. But,
it's regarded as a very high practice also today, both among tantrics and non-tantricas. It's regarded as a very high practice. And not that many practices anymore, is my assumption. Haven't met that many. Mellingson met a few. Another mudra that could be served here is Vajroli mudra. This is like a damage control at this point in history. It's like a damage control to ensure celibacy. It prevents the loss of semen. So this is simply like we create a vacuum in the stomach, similar to Nauli. It's not described as Nauli, but and then you insert a pipe into the penis and then you can suck up fluids again. It doesn't say in all texts that you need a pipe, but that it could be done without is up to discussion, questionable. We've never seen it.
It should be done without, actually, because it should be done inside the woman.
Inside the woman, yeah, that's for the tantric version. That's a different version than this one. We're going to look at the tantric parallel to this. Because it seems like we have these two, and this one was especially very easily appropriated by tantric traditions. Because we have to remember, not all ascetics were celibate. So for some of them, this was also a means of, what do you say, having one's cake while eating it. Simply. Also, it fits very well with the general reason for the Hatha text to be produced, aiming at the householder. The householder could remain sexually active, but still have the positive benefits of their yoga practice by doing this. That's one model of the yogic body. So this is about drying up, keeping the Bindu in the head. I call it the dried up body. They call it Bindu Dharana in the texts. But now we're going to look at a very completely different body, which might seem more familiar, the juiced up body. This model originated in tantric tradition and was later assimilated with Hatha yogic traditions. Most prominent and influential model of this tantric yogic body, of course there were many among the tantrics, is from the Kupchikamata Tantra, the Western transmission of which Goraksha and Matsyendra are said to have come from. In this body, we have the psychophysical centers, the chakras, wheels, also known as padmas, lotuses, and they are... Now I'm going to say they are placed along the main channel in the body, but now I make it sound like it's something physical. It's not necessarily physical. We have seen that especially in the early texts, like the Netra Tantra, that the chakras were created this yogic body were created by the practitioner and the tradition. Gavin would say they inscribe the tradition on the body. So these are more like meditation focuses, tools that can guide you through the meditation and help you create this body. The standard system here developed comprises six chakras. We sometimes call it a 6+1 system as well. The seven chakras, which we know very well today, one is located outside the physical body. Hence, the yogic body is not only a physical empirical size. It doesn't mean that they were not real for the yogis, these chakras. And we have many systems that have different numbers, different locations. Some of them have no locations at all. When I work with I work a lot with modern day Aguris and Nav yogis, many of them who do still practice this Kundalini-based chakra meditation. Some days I visit them and then say, oh, there's one chakra, and the next day they say 11, and a week after they say 7. It depends on the practice, and this is a system constructed. Yeah?
Depends on the scripture they're following as well.
If yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you go to Raksha Shataka, they're going to mention
different ones.
Depends. Hatha Yoga Pradipika is not the main one for Natas.
Oh, they use the Yuga Bija a lot as well.
Yes, but the Guraksha Shataka
is
the main one.
But but these are also some of us.
And the system of chakras are completely different. And actually, the system of the six chakras that is used in modern Hatha Yoga centers normally, it is widely criticized in other aspects of the Natha tradition and in Tantra, because they are, as you said, they are to be built internally. So it's different from imagining something in the body. So the Tantricas don't believe that this is effective.
Exactly.
So even if you get back to Matendranath, which was the Tantric master of Gorakshanath, he has completely different set of
chakras.
Understanding of it. And
yeah.
What they disbelieved to be his scripture.
Exactly. This is just the most standardized, that became standardized, is the chakra system as we see it from Kupchi Kamata Tantra. That became standard also outside of India. In modern yoga traditions, you often hear seven chakras mentioned, right?
Yeah, so what is this called? So the seven chakras, the one that is very popular now.
Yeah.
What is it based on?
It's based on the Kupchi Kamata Tantra, okay. Which is a 10th century Shakta tantric text focused around the goddess Kupchika.
Okay.
Yeah. That's mainly where we have it from. So far established. Again, like how much of the tantric material is actually translated? Very, very few. Scholarship didn't have a very big interest in this kind of practical physical yoga. We're going to look on that in next session to see how the modern yoga boom actually happened. Hatha yoga were excluded from the initial stages of this. Because Vivekananda and other people liked the rational, philosophical kind of yoga and thought that all the tantric practices were these transgressive, malevolent, sinister yogis, simply said. Yeah.
One thing that I keep finding over here is that he first showed certain pictures of Shiva and Durga. As you're going deeper and deeper into the tantric yogic practice, the theism seems to be put aside.
Yeah.
More the practice comes
yeah.
in. The ritual in themselves are more important than bhakti or the bhagat. The Bhagavan is not important anymore.
Well, you have to become the Bhagavan yourself in many tantric traditions to even be able to worship them. And all the different systems within the Mantra Maga and the Kula Maga have a different set of mantras, a different set of deities. So I'm taking it out here because it could be done with Shiva as the biggest god or Kupchika as the biggest god, or we even see the Vaishnava Tantras. So that's not the main focus here. And I would like to challenge the thing that Hatha Yoga came from an extremely Shaiva environment and open up the possibility of it coming from some celibate, extra-Vedic, ascetic traditions, as we will see after the tantric body. Another concept in this yogic body is Kundalini, she who is coiled, if I should do a translation. It's a goddess personified as a feminine power, Shakti, we often know it as. Also known as a snake goddess, that's like stimulated to actualize spiritual potential, you can say. She lies at the base of the spine, often blocking the main entrance to the main channel, in this text known as Sushumna. When she straightens up, when she's awakened by yogic meditation, she straightens and she pierces the knots, the grantees, which are like blockages in the body, through this central axis of the body. And first that leads to Siddhi's magical powers. But of course the final aim is that she meets Shiva, who's residing in the head. And then it is bestowed with liberation, because Shiva and Shakti are dissolved into each other. Laya, again, dissolve. So here the stuff that moves around the channel in the yogic body is more Kundalini. However, when Kundalini reaches the store of Amrita, which is also located in the head, this nectar, she takes the Amrita down to the spine. She travels back to her place here, and then the body is flooded with Amrita. That's why we have the juiced up body. Here the body is supposed to be nourished and flooded with all this nectar of immortality. As in the other yogic body system, we keep it in the head. The dried up body versus the juiced up body. And this is what's inside the Hatha Pradipika. These two models conflict a lot in the text. And they have been mixed. And if you ask one practitioner today in India and Nepal, they will have one view on it, and some will have other views. But most of the time they're actually mixed without great problems. The one system, the one we had earlier, has roots in these mortifying tapas-oriented celibate ascetics. And in this later model, the aim is not to mortify the body, it's more body-affirming, and it's more about cultivating the body. Something I would say we can owe a lot of the credits to Tantra for as well. So we also have an ontological clash, because Bindu is a real physical substance and Kundalini is definitely not something we empirically or physically can see move around in the body. There is also stories of later reform Hindu movement people, we're going to look at that later, who took a body up of the Ganga and desiccated it looking for the chakras, and well, upon not finding them, threw the Pradipika and the body back in the river. Simply discarded Hatha Yoga because it was not a physical reality that's presented. We also have a kit. Yeah?
Can I just compliment the Kundalini? Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
The Kundalini is a process to be felt. So it's just like something that's different. It's not a visualization. It's something to be felt. So you're supposed to feel in the body. So that's why the analogy with the snake. It's so intense because it's something that you feel going up on your body. Of course, they gave the explanation they could at that time, and you know that there isn't a snake inside, but the feeling is there, and the feeling needs to be felt. So it's not a visualization, and it's not so subjective. It's something that you need to feel, like most of the tantric practices.
Most of the tantric practices are like that, yeah.
If you don't feel, and you cannot understand what you're feeling, or you cannot replicate that or talk with your guru about what you're feeling, that's how you know that the person is not progressing.
Yeah.
Because the person didn't achieve that level. So.
Well, that's again, you can read all you want about Kundalini and tantric tradition, but that's not going to get you anywhere.
So you need to be guided to it, and you need to feel it.
Which
so
is also why we have a guru importance very highly in the tantric traditions. Yeah, because that is very important. Yeah?
This juiced up model, the newer model, and is it looked at by tantric practitioners as being maybe the more easy, softer option?
Not the more softer option at all.
Spirits, or
not at all softer.
The dried up one looks a bit more harder, isn't it, to do or achieve?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's that this is easier achieving. Like, the tantric system is often known to be quicker, but if not done properly, it can be very dangerous as well. That's often what's written in the tantras. And I wouldn't say which one of the bodies is oldest.
So would this be for the lower level aspirants in some respects? Less dangerous, less...
This is a combination of two systems, the Hatha Pradipika. So you wouldn't have in a tantric session saying, hey, you are a better aspirant or a lower aspirant, you practice the dried up body and you practice the juiced up body. They wouldn't do that. They come from two competing systems.
Right.
in a sense.
You were saying that what the Vedic practice would be looked at by the tantric practitioners are slightly lower. This doesn't equate to that.
Well, of course, the tantric traditions would always say that they're better. Their own model is more advanced and better. I suppose the Bindu Dharana opponents would say the opposite. Depends on who you're asking.
So similarly, do they have a view on this being... That's what I meant by a softer option.
Oh, yeah, possibly. Yeah, I wouldn't be sure about that. Yeah.
So just that I get this right. So the juiced-up body is based on the tantric tradition and the dried-up body is based on ascetic tradition?
They're both ascetic, but yeah, a celibate ascetic tradition, which probably was non-Vedic, but again, we don't know, because then we have the Vaishnavas, who definitely can be Vedic. And also, yes, yes. Yeah.
The level of practitioner depends on where you are in terms of practice. So if you are not there, if you're not someone that is considered that has control over your senses, you are not supposed to practice it. So no guru is going to initiate in this particular type of practice, because as she said, it's very hard practice, because you are not there enjoying, like we see modern practice today, having fun. It is, you need to really have control of the whole situation, not only in a physical body, but internally and emotionally. So it's a practice just for Vedas. It's not a practice for people that cannot control it. And it's so transgressive, because you destroy many things that you assumed they are stable in your life. So, and eating meat was something, sex was something. So these things are supposed to challenge you, what you think you know. So it's not for everyone. And
I'm getting now completely confused.
Yeah.
We started off looking at Shakta, where we looked at the Ugra Kali and the Shanti Madurga. Then we went into Tantric. What is the relation between the Tantric and the Shakta tradition?
Like Shaivism, we have a Puranic and we have a non-Puranic, I would say.
So
but the Shakta tradition, like...
Is a Puranic?
That's the Devi Mahatmya, like a small part of the Markandeya Purana, right?
Coming to is Devi Mahatmya, because at the Sharvashram, Devi Mahatmya plays a very important part. And the whole idea of the concept of the left and the right, there it comes in, because she has to take the Ugra Rupa, because almost like you're fighting fire with fire.
That thing. That's the logic,
plus,
yeah.
Also, like Rakta Biju and various other people, she doesn't take the nice form because she doesn't want him to fall in love with her. So she has to take the most vile form possible, and the concept of the Rakta Biju, why she drinks the blood.
Yeah.
Because every drop will become the next Rakta Biju. And then the whole thing is summed up, is that you want jnana or do you want material gain?
Yeah.
And the person chooses jnana. So the whole thing comes down into these things not necessarily happening, but these are the rakshasas of your mind.
Yeah, that's one way to solve that, you have both tendency, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That's what the systems do all the time.
Yeah, so in other words, what I'm trying to say is that Kali is not necessarily that Ugra Kali. Sometimes the bad thoughts, you have to fight it with force.
Yeah, sometimes she's Saumya as well.
Yeah, and then you're doing that internally. So even though it is described
exactly.
externally.
But some do it externally as well. That's the whole thing, that
yeah,
we have both.
That's when I think a lot of the doubts and the downfall happens. That's a very vicious form of practice.
Well, yeah, but for some people and some cults, that has been the form of practice. I'm not here to judge whether blood sacrifices are right or wrong and it's a vicious form of practice or not. That's definitely different interpretations of the same system, I would say. Yeah. What I would like to say before we head off here is, like, the Khichari Mudra described in this context, the transformed Bindu is not supposed to stay in the head, but is supposed to flood the body, the juiced up body. So hence we have two models that are merged together. Again, we see it with the Vajrayana Mudra as well. In the tantric traditions, Bhadruli Mudra became to combine feminine sexual fluid or menstrual blood with Bindu semen in one's own body. So we produce these sexual substances and we suck them up and turn them into amrita in the body. This is because bodily fluids were seen as one of the ultimate offerings to the goddess, and it's a union of male and female principles. So there's also a lot of this philosophies and overcoming dualities in it. A popular notion of tantric sex is that it's about forsaking orgasm, but a key purpose of the ritual was to produce these power substances, simply. So what we see in the Hatha Pradipika is a classical Hatha yoga, which excluded mantra yoga totally, not mentioned, we don't have any mantras. Laya is incorporated under the name Hatha. These two yogic models were combined. So what actually happened is what I would say is a shaktization of Hatha yoga. Not just an acquisition of Hatha yoga, but a full transformation of it, a successful one as well. Yogis today, and when the British arrived, were often seen as very transgressive people who did these practices, and not all of them did. Some were celibate, ascetic, Vedic. Some were not. It also happened as a reformation of tantric yoga. Tantric yoga became less esoteric and became democratized, came out to a wider audience, which fits well with this whole householder aim of the Hatha yoga corpus. Yeah. All last, I would like to say a bit about asanas. Because we have not talked much about that, and this is where it becomes very important. There are two reasons for asana, two sources, as we could say. One is a seated posture for meditation or pranayama. I think this is the most common definition of asana. We see it in the Patanjali Yoga Sastra, we see it in the Tantras. Around the 14th century, asana became a normal word for all kinds of posture, like used in wrestling and for battling elephants and I don't know what, like asana became a very general term. However, ascetics have been practicing something similar in ages. Tapas, oriented to tapas, ascetic austerities. This is not explicitly associated with yoga or is an aim of yoga, but it has been interconnected since at least the time of the Buddha. The physical techniques that later became known as mudras and asanas has forerunners associated with tapas mentioned in the epics, in the Mahabharata, in the Pali canon, in the Jain canon. One example is in Punjab in the 4th century, members of Alexander the Great's encouraged passed a group of ascetics. 15 men standing in different postures, sitting or lying down naked, who continued in these positions until evening and then returned to the city. The most difficult thing to endure was the heat of the sun, which was so powerful that no one else could endure without pain to walk on the ground at midday with bare feet. So why do they do these austerities? They sit in one asana for 10 hours in the sun. Again, we have established that existence is suffering, right? And this is related to this. It's about burning away old karma and stopping from preventing new. By doing these motionless austerities, you could burn away the old karma and prevent new from developing. Hence, you solve the problem of existence. The text of Hatha Yoga watered these practices down and made them available to a bigger audience. It also added, in the Pradipika, in the Tantras, around places, the healthy, therapeutic affects, which could be related to that these ascetic practices were made mainstream for the householder because they were most likely more concerned about health benefits than many of the yogis were. The purpose of asana and the Pradipika is to get rid of diseases and make firmness in the body. And there are special benefits for each asana. We just like to say the earliest reference to an unseated asana is probably Mayurasana, the peacock, and it comes from a Pancharatra text, Sri Vaishnavism. Tantric Vaishnavism again. So if we agree with Mallinson, it seems likely that non-seated asanas originated in this milieu, Tantric Vaishnavism. Hence, the oldest non-seated asana we know the root of is from Vaishnavism. Yeah. And so conclusion, I would say, what is the Hatha Pradipika? It's a reformation of tantric yoga that severed it from its roots. You have no mention of specific deities. It's ascribed to Shiva in the beginning. You don't have, like, they don't even mention all the chakras. They don't have a specific chakra system. So it became like where you took all this and make it more universal. You tried to make yoga universal and adaptable for everyone. And you also tried to make tantric yoga less esoteric.